I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. As humorist Andy Borowitz tweeted this morning, President Obama has done a pretty good job considering he's not from here. Borowitz, one of a chorus of voices responding to the re-entry into the presidential race of the notion long disproved that President Obama was not born here. And today, analysts are wondering, what was Mitt Romney thinking, aligning himself with the man behind the birther claims yesterday at Trump International Hotel in Las Vegas, instead of basking in his delicate win in Texas, which put him over the top on his way to the party nomination? Bloomberg Businessweek's Josh Green writes today that it was consultant Mark Penn who started this idea of Obama as other, encouraging Hillary Clinton to use it during the 2008 presidential campaign, something she rejected, by the way. But Josh writes, under Republicans, it's metastasized into the birther movement, false claims the president was not born here. Rick Klein is senior Washington editor for ABC World News and co-host of that network's political webcast, Top Line. Rick, you say this is a revealing moment about how the Romney campaign is thinking. What is it revealing? What are they thinking?
They're thinking that they cannot anger Donald Trump at this stage. And there's a couple reasons for that. One is, he's Donald Trump, and he's more valuable on the inside than the outside because he's going to make his noise regardless. The other thing, and this is a little more nuanced, Mitt Romney is not a believer in the birther movement. He believes that President Obama was born in the United States, but a good chunk of his supporters are and do have doubts. And so for him to outright disavow and repudiate Donald Trump would mean potentially alienating a lot of the folks he needs to get on board. So even now, in the general election, when the focus is on independent voters, he needs to lock down his conservative Republican base.
But Rick Klein, he didn't have to. I mean, why even have that meeting on that day? I mean, everyone knows what Donald Trump stands for. The meeting could have been on Friday of this week. I mean, people are asking, you know, was this a blunder by a tone-deaf Mitt Romney campaign or a cynical move to restart the birther debate on this such an important day in the campaign? You say that once he got there, he can't respond. You know, that responds to people who say, why didn't he do a John McCain thing and say, no, as John McCain said to a woman who said Barack Obama was an Arab, John McCain said, well, no, ma'am, he's not. You're saying that's why Mitt Romney could do that, but why even set up that day?
Oh, I don't think this was planned. I really think this was a couple of errors and then hoping that Donald Trump would keep his mouth shut, and of course that didn't happen, and then they were so far in that they couldn't cancel and shuttle the whole day. I don't think this worked out to his benefit on balance. Now look, it's 5 months before the election. There's lots of time. Maybe you're better off having Trump-dominated headlines about birthers in May than you are in October. I think that's a given. But no, I don't think this was a particularly shining day for the Romney campaign. They were on the defensive all day, and Donald Trump, as he is wont to do, ended up chewing up all of the airspace and the airtime of the day talking about his doubts about President Obama's birth status.
Well, there was another issue raised yesterday. Reuters reports that the Romney campaign gave his Romney's birth certificate to Reuters, and on that certificate it clearly shows that Romney's father, George Romney, was born in Mexico, as Reuters writes. This is reviving the debate from the 1968 presidential race in which George Romney, the candidate, faced his own birther movement. A candidate whose father had these same kind of attacks, putting himself in this position where he has to stand by while someone else launches a birther movement.
It's amazing the way that history comes full circle in these times. I don't think Mitt Romney sees any interest in having the birther movement play out, but I do think he sees an interest in making sure that those who harbor these doubts don't feel like they don't have their voice heard at all. So he does try to play it both ways by having someone like Donald Trump out there. You can't be held responsible for everything that every one of your supporters say, clearly, but you're not forced to sit down at a fundraiser at the hotel
right.
That bears the man's name.
I have to go back at one thing, Rick Klein, that you said. You said you're in the camp that believes this was just a blunder maybe on Romney's part and not cynical. The Washington Post's Phil Rucker reminds us, of course, Mitt Romney is also considered an outsider by many in the GOP, a New Englander, a Mormon. He potentially yesterday became the first Mormon nominee for president. Some would say that inviting Donald Trump to sort of step up and do his thing and cast Obama as an outsider is deflecting from his own outsider nature.
But the other side of that is that if you start talking about others as outsiders, then you highlight some of the things you don't want to talk about. Mitt Romney has never been fully comfortable talking about his own religion. That's one reason why they're not going to go close to the Reverend Wright story, because they don't want stories about Mitt Romney's church to be considered fair game by the media. But so I do think it is an intriguing matchup in a lot of ways. I think these two men, they have demeanors that in some ways are similar, and they're cool and sort of above the fray take. And I think they also have elements of their upbringing that are unusual. And neither of these men is white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, which of course is what almost every president that this nation's ever had has been.
Rick Klein, senior Washington editor for ABC World News, co-host of that network's political webcast, Top Line. Thanks, as always.
Thank you.
Police in New York say they've not yet decided whether to renew their search for the remains of Eitan Peetz after last week's confession in the case. Pedro Hernandez reportedly confessed to killing the 6-year-old boy back in 1979, even though, by the way, a jailed molester named Jose Ramos was accused by a judge in 2005 of killing the boy. The Peetz case is opening a lot of old wounds, but it's also giving hope to people like our next guest. Melanie Perkins has been haunted by the disappearance of her childhood friend, Andy Buglisi, ever since he vanished in 1976. She went back to their hometown, Lawrence, Massachusetts, as an adult to investigate. Her film, Have You Seen Andy, won an Emmy. In it, one of Andy's other childhood friends talks to Melanie about the disappearance.
I liked Andy and we hung out, but I was a little mad because I liked you and you liked him, and that bugged me.
I can remember too a lot of the kids playing a part in the search themselves.
And all the kids got together in the woods and held hands and walked like through the thick grass and stuff like that, looking for him, calling his name and stuff like that, yeah.
Well, today is Missing Children's Day here in Massachusetts. Melanie will join families of missing children at the State House ceremony, but first joins us to talk about her continuing search, a conversation, by the way, that will not be appropriate for children. Melanie, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you.
Andy would be how old now?
47.
So what was it like for you to hear the Eitan Peetz news that someone had confessed in that abduction?
Actually, I was in my kitchen last week. I had been paying attention since last month when they were digging up the basement. But last week, for whatever reason, in the kitchen, I just burst into tears and I couldn't stop crying. I think it was the confession. It was thinking about his parents and what they must be going through right now and his childhood friends. And I think everybody's just riveted to their TV to find out whether this story is going to have an ending or not.
So, you know, we forget about the childhood friends.
Yeah. I think all the time about those little kids. You know, everybody has heard the story that Eitan was going to school. You know, it was his first day. His mom let him walk to the school bus by himself. And I think all the time about those other little kids at the school that he was with that know that, you know, he didn't get off the bus that day.
Yeah. Well, we're going to link our listeners to our interview with you about the documentary you made about your friend, Andy. But I'll just give a little thumbnail here to start. Andy went missing from a state swimming pool on a hot summer day in 1976. You're 9. He was 10. You'd asked him to walk you home because you had a crush on him. He wanted to stay at the pool, so you left, and that was the last you saw of him. But first of all, Eitan Peetz got so much attention in 1979, but this was 3 years after Andy went missing.
That's right.
Why didn't Andy's case get more attention?
I think it's so interesting when I went back historically to look at other cases of missing children, and it wasn't just Andy's case that didn't get so much attention. I thought Andy's case was rare when I was a kid. And when I grew up, I found out that it's rare, I guess. But in Massachusetts, there had been other children that had been missing, like Andy, a year or two before him, from Massachusetts, from not very far away. Lee Savoy from Revere, Mass., disappeared in 1974, 6-7 years old, never seen again. His family has never gotten any media attention to this day. So every case is different. I think Eitan's case was such that it was New York City, so there was a lot of media, a lot of publicity there already. It was so random. He was, you know, 6 years old. He was a little bit younger than Andy, so I think people really, that struck a chord with a lot of people as well. And in Andy's case, as is the case with a lot of children, initially people suggest that they are runaways, right? And so they don't maybe look for them right away or consider them abducted. Mm-hmm. Whereas with Eitan, nobody thought that a 6-year-old had run away.
I mean, he literally walked the block and was gone. Well, you revived interest in Andy's case. You went to Lawrence, as we said, in 1998, started to work on your documentary, opened a post office box. You start getting anonymous tips. You find a letter in Andy's police files. It mentions a man named Charles Pierce, who was in prison for killing a young girl in a town near Lawrence. This would be Boxford, Massachusetts. But he had also confessed to killing a child in Lawrence, and there was no follow-up on that, even though Andy had disappeared from Lawrence?
None that I could see. And when I asked police about it, a lot of the folks said that they didn't know about it. And so I contacted the person who wrote the letter and said, yeah, we never heard back from police saying that they were interested. At the time, I was lucky enough to have the Boston Globe following me as I was doing the documentary. So there were resources that the Globe had, of course, that I didn't. So I had no idea who Charlie Pierce was. I think we had his date of birth and that was it.
Yeah.
So I was able to give that information to the Globe reporter, Judith Gaines, who called me that night and said, you are not going to believe this.
This being that somebody had written a letter about Charlie Pierce, who turned out to be in prison for killing a child.
Exactly. I mean, we didn't know who Charlie Pierce was. When we saw the letter, we were like, okay, so there was a letter from a prison that said a prisoner had confessed to, you know, abducting a little boy from Lawrence, Massachusetts, but we didn't know what his history was. We didn't know if he was just some random person or what. What we ended up finding out because of the Boston Globe reporter was that this person was in jail for murdering a child one town away from where Andy disappeared. So suddenly, of course, he became a lot more credible based on his history.
And I'm thinking, too, that it's chillingly like the Pates case. In the Pates case, we now have a suspect who has confessed to killing a boy, not in jail, but to a prayer group. There's another suspect in the Pates case who swears he didn't do it, but he is also in jail, charged with molesting other children. So
right.
there are these almost connections. So in your storyline, you have Charles Pierce in prison. He knew a man named Wayne W. Chapman, who was eventually convicted of raping two little boys in Lawrence. This was the year before Andy disappeared. Boys you knew. You believe Wayne killed Andy. Why?
I think there's a lot of evidence that Wayne Chapman abducted Andy and very likely was involved in his death because there were children there who saw things that day that the police at the time in 1976, you know, children were considered to be seen and not heard. They weren't considered credible witnesses. And there were children 30 years later that I interviewed that had seen things that they had said the whole entire time they had seen. And I was able to corroborate based on their timing.
Things like what?
Like seeing Wayne Chapman asking Andy to help him find a dog, like approaching other children that same day, Wayne Chapman approaching other children that same day asking to help find a lost dog, seeing Andy being attacked in the woods by three individuals, he said. He could only see them from the back. Who are the other two? I don't know, and I have my own sort of ideas of who they might be. But I think the important thing about you talk, Robin, about the similarities with Charles Pierce and Wayne Chapman and the suspects in Eitan Patz's case with one confessing and the other denying. And I have to say, one of the things that I feel like I found in Andy's case was that sometimes people will confess to crimes that didn't commit the crime. And in Andy's case, I think Charlie Pierce was confessing to the crime to throw detectives off of Wayne Chapman because Wayne Chapman was about to be released from prison and Charlie Pierce knew he was dying and he was not getting out. So it was sort of as a favor, if you will, to Wayne Chapman that he would deflect attention, in my opinion, onto him so that maybe, you know, Wayne Chapman could get out and he would not be considered a suspect.
So this might have been a ring.
Very likely. In Andy's case, I definitely think that it was a pedophile ring.
So why wasn't Wayne Chapman ever charged in Andy's case? We're going to have more with filmmaker and advocate Melanie Perkins about the disappearance of her friend Andy Puglisi back in 1976 in 1 minute, here and now. Welcome back to our conversation with Melanie Perkins. And a reminder, if you're just joining us, it is a difficult one. We're talking about missing children. Melanie made a documentary about the 1976 disappearance of her childhood friend Andy Puglisi in Lawrence, Massachusetts. We were reminded of Andy's story last week when a man named Pedro Hernandez was charged with the 1979 murder of Eitan Pates in New York after police said was a confession. But there had been another suspect in the Pates case, Jose Ramos. He's in prison on charges of molesting children. He's up for a parole. And at least one detective in the Pates case has wondered if Hernandez, the most recent suspect, and Ramos may have worked together. Well, Melanie Perkins has some of the same suspicions about the case of her friend Andy Puglisi. No one has seen him since he disappeared from a public swimming pool 36 years ago. It's complicated, so we'll go over it again. A prisoner wrote a tip to police back then saying another inmate had confessed to killing a boy in the same town as Andy, but no one ever investigated that tip. And Melanie now thinks that confession was to throw police off the trail of another man, Wayne W. Chapman. He was convicted of raping two little boys, boys Melanie also knew, in Lawrence back in 1975, the year before Andy disappeared. Melanie also found witnesses who said they'd seen Wayne Chapman approach Andy and other children the day he disappeared. Melanie feels that the inmate who claimed to have killed a child, Charles Pierce, who was in prison for killing a young girl in a nearby town, may have made that claim to somehow cover for Wayne Chapman. So, Melanie, Wayne Chapman, you have some chilling sound in your film. It's very difficult to hear, but this is Wayne Chapman, the man you suspect, recording himself while he stalks children, some of them on a school bus.
School bus just passed me with a load of kids. I wonder if there's any boys in there. There comes two boys now. One of them looked pretty good there.
It's just sickening. As we said, he was ultimately convicted of raping two little boys. He's still in prison because he's been civilly committed. In other words, officials felt he did his time, but they couldn't release him.
He was considered to be a still sexually dangerous person. So under a civil commitment, he was sent back to prison. But interestingly, he is coming up for hearing June 11th. So it's going to be a jury trial, and they will determine whether Wayne Chapman is considered to be still a sexually dangerous person. So every year he can come up for trial and be reviewed as to his sexual dangerousness. Last year he opted not to have the hearing. This year he is having the hearing. 2 years ago he had a hearing with a jury, and you know, every year we never know whether he's going to be released. He could walk free next week. We have no idea.
Why hasn't there been an investigation of whether or not he killed your friend Andy?
Well, because he has a right not to incriminate himself, so he cannot, he doesn't have to be questioned by attorneys, and there's no physical evidence, right? They've never found Andy's body, so that's critical. And I think in the Eitan Patz's case, it's critical as well. I think it's going to be very hard, unfortunately, to convict anyone, even if they confess to this crime. There haven't been many convictions of a child or of murder without a body, as far as I can tell, as far as the district attorney's offices have told me. I think there's a lot of circumstantial evidence against Wayne Chapman, where they could get a grand jury to decide whether there was enough evidence to prosecute, but the district attorney unfortunately disagrees.
But we mentioned that people in your position, many are taking hope from Eitan Patz's case. You know, somebody came forward and said, I know something, and then there was a confession. Again, we don't know if this is the end of the story, but it could be. Do you think that that's the kind of thing that has to happen?
I do. I think that people should always have hope in these cases, and I think that nobody vanishes into thin air. It's physically not possible. So I think that there are always something that is there that is evidence that has not been looked at yet, hasn't been unturned, just hasn't been looked at. And I think that in Eitan's case, you know, I really hope that for the family, this is the end of the story for them. And I think it does give hope to the rest of us. I think J.C. Lee Ducard's case gives hope to the rest of us. I think Elizabeth Smart, I mean, all of them do. And so that's what parents and families and loved ones of children with who are missing have to deal with all the time, is this hope that comes up, and sometimes it's dashed again and sometimes it's not. And it's a very emotional experience for everyone involved. So my heart just goes out to that family and to all families of children who are missing.
By the way, are the Puglisi parents still alive?
Yes.
Have you spoken to them since the Pates news?
I did. I actually called Andy's mother Sunday, past Sunday.
How is she doing with this?
You know, we were talking to each other because I was saying that, you know, I'm a spiritual person, you know, and I have been feeling Andy's presence in my heart lately. And I just called her even before Eitan's case broke. And I said I was just feeling something and I didn't know what it was. And she hadn't gotten a chance to get back to me. And we just finally connected on Sunday to talk. And I said, you know, I don't know if this was part of what it was, or that, you know, Wayne Chapman's being released or what. But I think about Andy pretty much every day. But sometimes I dream about him more and I think about him more. And a lot of times when that happens, I feel like it's a little bit like, you know, the book, The Lovely Bones. Sometimes I feel like it's, you know, whatever, the universe, his spirit, I don't know what, you know, sort of trying to move things in a different direction. I don't know. But I've been feeling Andy a lot more lately.
And Mrs. Puglisi, how is she doing with the Pates news?
She has had a lot of these cases over the years, as you can imagine, so they always stir up more, you know. And I think that having each other to talk to, and I think that that's really important for other families to reach out to families who have been through similar situations. Only those families can really know what they're going through. So I think that being able to talk about it is really important. So Faith and I being able to talk to each other on Sunday was really important because, you know, there have been other times where we've been on this emotional roller coaster together. And so we talk about it. And we talk about Andy and we talk about what we miss. And then we talk a lot about the Pates family and what we hope for them. And, you know, it's sad. I mean, there's no way around it. She feels sad.
She's so lucky to have you.
Well, I feel really lucky to have them.
That's Melanie Perkins. The documentary she made is Have You Seen Andy? About the disappearance of her childhood friend Andy Puglisi in 1976. Melanie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And again, Wayne Chapman, who is civilly committed and Melanie suspects in the disappearance of her friend, is up for a release hearing next month. Jose Ramos, who a judge declared guilty in 2005 of killing Eitan Pates, is due to be released November 7th. Latest news is next, here and now. What has George W. Bush been up to? At a recent event, the former president endorsed Mitt Romney barely as elevator doors closed on him. Memorial Day, we saw a profound picture of him at a mountain bike race, shaking hands with a veteran missing her left leg, a reminder of his role in two wars. But President Bush has been off the radar, and tomorrow he returns to the White House, his first trip back in 2 years, for the unveiling of his presidential portrait. Wayne Slater is senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News. Wayne, we recently did a story on the tax-paid expenses of former presidents. George Bush had an $80,000 phone bill last year, not as much as Bill Clinton's rent, but still, he seemed to be being busy. Doing what?
No, he is busy. He's calling a lot of people. He's showing up different places. He is doing exactly what he said he wanted to do when he left office, that is to keep a fairly low profile, not be a pontificator on the President of the United States. And so much of his interest right now and where we see him in Dallas is focused on the Bush Library and the Bush Center. The library is scheduled to open in 2013. And they've already begun classes and had programs with various dissidents and others from around the world at the site. That's his number one focus right now.
This is at Southern Methodist University. He's raised about $300 million for the library. You mentioned the dissidents. He unveiled earlier this month the Freedom Collection. That's a group of interviews with dissidents who took on autocratic regimes. That's been his passion.
That has been his passion, and that's what you're going to see in this Bush Library and Bush Center. You're going to see exhibits that really reflect his freedom initiative, the idea that the United States ought to support those and confront autocratic regimes and promote the idea of democracy around the world. That's the strength that Bush thinks he brings, and that's what Karl Rove, his political consultant, is doing in assisting how that's going to be depicted at the library. A lot of people can criticize him for the wars and for the problems of the administration, but Bush sees that as the number one legacy of his 8 years in office.
Well, I wonder if, you know, maybe in time, but you could wonder maybe he's been off the radar because he knows that he also reminds people of the war in Iraq, which, you know, some people feel was unjustified. It's difficult to talk about going after autocrats if some people feel you went after the wrong one.
Yeah, this really is, in a political way, exactly the sort of Rove doctrine, his good political advisor, who said you go after an opponent's strengths and make them the weakness. The reverse of that is that you make your weaknesses strengths. And in the case of Bush, it was questions about the war, questions about this freedom initiative, how he pushed it. Nobody disagrees with freedom, but what actually were the policies of the administration, whether it's waterboarding, whether it's going after terrorism, whatever, as well as the economy. So what you do is you try to make these weaknesses strengths, and that, in a political sense, is what Karl Rove is advising right now.
Well, meanwhile, the Bushes will dine with the Obamas tomorrow night at the White House. President Bush has talked about inheriting the economy. President Bush has talked about a new book that's coming out this summer that will outline his strategy for economic growth. So, just briefly, how do you think that dinner's going to go?
I think the dinner will go fine. Bush is actually, if you know him privately, and I do, is quite an engaging guy. I suspect that he'll give a little advice to the president if the president asks for it. But this whole idea of Bush coming out in a couple of months with a book about the economic growth might strike some critics as Rush Limbaugh, like Rush Limbaugh trying to teach gender sensitivity classes to folks. Bush seems like the last guy to preach and to talk about the idea of economic growth, but that's exactly what he's going to do. I suspect that's not a big part of the discussion tomorrow.
Wayne Slater of the Dallas Morning News, ahead of tomorrow's meeting in the White House between former President Bush and current President Obama. Wayne, thanks so much.
Great to be with you, Robin.
And by the way, a quick note, tomorrow we'll be remembering Doc Watson with an old friend, guitar maker Wayne Henderson.
Fortunately, Doc, you know, liked to hang around my shop, and he was around a lot, and he was always talking about his instruments, you know, and talked about what kind of neck he likes to play and the action on his fingerboard and string spacing and stuff like that.
Remembering Doc Watson tomorrow, we can start doing that right now as we listen, here and now. There's going to be a runoff in Texas for the Senate seat soon to be vacated by Kay Bailey Hutchinson. Texas Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst, backed by Rick Perry and the Republican establishment, will face off against Tea Party favorite Ted Cruz, Sarah Palin's pick. The Democratic runoff pits Paul Sadler against Grady Yarborough. But Republicans are largely expected to win this seat. And either way, women will lose it, meaning lose one of only 17 seats that women hold in the Senate. And Democrats in particular are hoping to make up for that lost ground with a record number of Democratic women running for Senate. Jennifer Lawless is director of the Women and Politics Institute at American University. Jennifer, some are saying that Democrats are relying on these women to keep control of the Senate.
That's right. Some of the most vulnerable seats that the Democrats will be defending this cycle are held by women. Claire McCaskill in Missouri is one example.
And Democrats are having to defend 23 of their 33 Senate seats. Well, let's start with Claire McCaskill in Missouri, because we're hearing that Democrats are pushing to the forefront a lot of women's issues because so many women are running for such key seats. She, however, is running in a conservative state. So tell us a little more about the tightrope she's walking.
Well, it's very difficult for women who are defending seats that are in districts or states that could easily go to the Republican or the Democrat. Because what we've seen over the course of the last 10 years is increased party polarization, where most of the Republicans support one thing and most of the Democrats support another. So Claire McCaskill is, for about half her state, a mismatch. And it's difficult to emphasize very Democratic positions or prioritize women's issues when you're out of sync with a majority of your constituents.
And she is running against former state treasurer Sarah Steelman, so another woman in the race. Tell us about some of the issues that are going to be at the forefront.
It had historically been the case that when issues like health care or child care or pay equity or gender equity or violence against women were at the forefront of the agenda, women were seen to have an advantage. Over time, Democratic women still have advantages on those issues, but Republican women are not perceived as more credible on those issues than men. So what has happened is the Democrats have really taken women's issues and run with them, and those women's issues are now seen as Democratic issues.
And let's talk about some of these issues that have been in the news lately that some say Democrats are pushing because they're looking for this women's vote. One came up in Missouri. This was the anti-violence bill that was so controversial in Congress. And when this came up in Missouri, Sarah Steelman said she was unfamiliar with that legislation. Now, women's groups went after her for that, but some of her conservative constituents, you know, this may also have let her off the hook with them.
That's right. And I think that violence against women is a perfect example of the evolution of women's issues over time. When the original Violence Against Women Act passed, there were only a handful of people, Democrats and Republicans alike, who voted against it. The fact that it's now seen as a partisan issue shows that there's no such thing as women's issues that transcend party anymore. And that makes it very, very difficult for women who are running who used to appeal to some crossover voters who cared about women's issues.
Well, and there was also the Blunt Amendment, which sought to allow employers to opt out of providing insurance coverage for contraceptives because of religious or moral objections. And this is any employer, not just a religious institution. And we mentioned the Violence Against Women Act. And then you come to Massachusetts. Elizabeth Warren, the consumer advocate, expected to face Republican Senator Scott Brown. We've talked about this race, and we'll link you to our reporting on that. Now, Brown was for the Blunt Amendment, which, again, would allow any employer to drop contraception coverage. But he was also for the Senate violence bill, which is more expansive than many Republicans want, splitting those women's issues, maybe complicating things for Elizabeth Warren.
Well, I don't know how much it complicates things for Elizabeth Warren, because being consistent on women's issues helps Elizabeth Warren. She can paint Scott Brown as being completely inconsistent. That inconsistency is going to be more of a liability in Massachusetts among independent voters, for example, than it would be in Missouri, where Claire McCaskill is running.
What other races are you looking at? What else is of interest to you?
Well, you know, what's interesting across the board is that a lot of the people who are up for re-election are people who are defending seats in states where it's unlikely that the Democrats should have won in the first place. So John Tester in Montana, or Jim Webb giving up his seat in Virginia, puts the Democrats in a very precarious position, because many would argue that that was not a seat that Jim Webb should have won in the first place. The reason that it's difficult for Democrats this cycle is because the conditions in 2006 favored them in a way that the conditions no longer do. So they're defending seats that were very unlikely pickups.
Which puts more pressure on the women who are running for some of these other seats.
That's exactly right. And in addition to that, it's important to note that currently there are 17 women in the Senate. Only 5 of them are Republicans, 2 of whom have decided to retire.
We noted Kay Bailey Hutchinson, the other Olympia Snow, who
right.
announced her retirement in Maine.
Right. And she will, in all likelihood, be replaced by a man.
Because Congresswoman Shelley Pingree, who's a favorite of Democrats, has decided not to run. So, as you said, there will probably be a man replacing Olympia Snow, another minus in the female column.
That's right. The other thing to keep in mind here is that 12 of the 17 women in the Senate are Democrats, which means that when the Democrats have a bad year, women are disproportionately affected. In all of Congress, among the women, about 70% of them are Democrats. So when the Democrats don't do well, or when they succumb to the vagaries of the political environment, Democratic women take a particular hit, which means generally that women take a hit because there are so few Republican women office holders at the national level. So it's not only that women are defending difficult seats, it's that any year when Democrats are defending difficult seats, women are especially vulnerable.
Well, many observers conclude that of the 6 Democratic women incumbents, Dianne Feinstein, California, Kirsten Gillibrand, New York, Amy Klobuchar, Minnesota, Maria Cantwell of Washington, they're all expected to hold on to their seats. But take a look at Wisconsin briefly before we let you go. U.S. Representative Tammy Baldwin, trying to be the state's first female senator, but also the first openly gay member of the Senate. What do you find interesting there?
Well, I think what's interesting is that a lot of the attention is placed on what makes these women unique, or on what it's like to have a female candidate running against a male candidate. But at the end of the day, that's not what matters to voters. What matters to voters is how the economy is doing and whether they think that one candidate or another is going to do a better job moving the country forward. So we can spend all of our time talking about this, and frankly, I do, and I think it's incredibly interesting. And having the first openly gay member of the Senate would be obviously a major milestone. But it's unlikely that those kinds of factors are in the top 10 on the average voter's list. And so I think we need to be careful when we're assessing and forecasting what's going to happen in these races to stray too far from the economy.
Jennifer Lawless, director of the Women in Politics Institute at American University. Thank you so much for taking a look at some of the female candidates as we head into the fall.
Thank you.
So what about you? Do you think female candidates make any kind of difference in the old boys network that is the U.S. Senate? Go to herenow.org, click on Contact Us to send an email. You can scroll down, leave a comment, or go to facebook.com/herenowradio. Back with the Game of Thrones cookbook here and now. Pass the mead cups and adjust your crown. That's the theme music for HBO's Game of Thrones, the series based on the best-selling novels by George R.R. Martin, his violently epic medieval fantasy about warring families vying for power over the mythical land of Westeros. But in between the bloody battles and palace intrigue,
Hey, warlords get hungry.
Bread and two of those little fish. And a mug of dark beer to wash it down. And bacon burnt black.
That famished fellow is Tyrion Lannister, played by Peter Dinklage. But why stop at bacon? How about a rack of lamb surrounded by turnips swimming in butter? Or Dornish snake with fiery sauce? Pigeon pie, cream swans, honeyed locusts. The food in Martin's novels inspired two roommates from Alston, Massachusetts, to cook up the dishes, then blog about it. And it became so popular they published a book. It's called A Feast of Ice and Fire. And the authors, and I guess we now call them chefs, join us in the studio. Chelsea Munro Castle, welcome.
Hi.
And welcome as well to your co-authors, Sari and Lara. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
So what, Chelsea, start with you. When did you start cooking some of these things that, well, are sort of, some of them seem familiar, but some are sort of unfathomable?
We actually started last March, and we were sitting in the kitchen one day talking about what we'd like to have for dinner and came to the realization that we were both really craving lemon cakes, which is sort of a signature dish of the book series. And while our first attempts at lemon cakes were good, they just didn't give us that wow factor of, like, innocence and summer and everything good about growing up in Winterfell.
Okay, so Sarianne, I'm sorry. We have to just now taste them because you've brought in a plate of the lemon cakes. Can you just tell us a little bit about them? I swing them over here. They look like petit fours.
They do. That's actually our modern recipe for the lemon cakes. We do have a historical recipe which we've based on actual source documents from, I believe they're Elizabethan.
What's the difference between your modern, and you do that in the book, you have a modern recipe and then you have one that is, as you said, from practically medieval times. What's the difference?
The Elizabethan ones are actually flatter, more like cookies, and these modern ones are almost a petit four, and we've actually made them probably at least 25 times now to really hone in on the perfect recipe.
And oh, they are good.
They are. They're fantastic.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the lemon is very much in sort of the icing that's on top. And then you have these beautiful, what are these, the flowers you've put on top?
Violets.
Violets with some sugar on top of them. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's very pretty. I know I'm tasting what I think is a delicious lemon cake. But what are you tasting when you taste this?
They taste like Sansa Stark. I mean, they're sweet, almost cloyingly sweet.
This is one of the characters.
Yes, yeah. Sansa Stark.
Is she the blonde, the character that has pet dragons?
That's Daenerys Targaryen.
Okay. All right.
Sansa Stark has red hair. She's
yes,
betrothed to King Joffrey.
And so this says Sansa to you?
Mm-hmm. It's innocent Sansa, yes, before everything went wrong for her.
So you're making these as fun, you know, for fun in your kitchen. Then you start blogging about them. Then you actually write George R.R. Martin to tell him what?
To tell him that he had inspired us to go ahead and try our hands at making some of the dishes from the books. He cautioned us away from some of the stranger foods.
Well, I'm thinking there's one character who ate a horse heart at one point.
It's true. We didn't do that level of authenticity when it came to the horse heart. But we did make faux heart cupcakes out of red velvet cupcake and fondant.
Ah.
So they were very convincing.
Well, and it's true that this is medieval times, knights and dragons and everything. So there's a lot of gnawing on, you know, legs of things. But you are staying. What else did you decide to stay away from?
We have only stayed away from things that are either illegal or impossible to obtain based on financial restraints. So, for example, we haven't cooked a whole swan.
Thank you.
Yes. Because I think we looked it up at one point and found we could get one for about $900. But the small print was that it would arrive live and still flapping.
Okay,
and that
well,
was well beyond our abilities.
No swans, no herons, no
right.
Dogs. Thank you again.
Yes.
No horse roasted with honey and peppers. Again, this is medieval time, so it's in the writing. But you do some exotic things that are acceptable, like honeyed locusts,
mm-hmm.
but certainly not locusts.
We actually used crickets. If we'd been able to find locusts, I think we probably would have done it. But Amazon.com apparently sells crickets, so there you have it.
There you go.
You can get everything online.
Well, and then the next thing you know, Mr. Martin has helped you. We understand he connected you with a publisher.
He did.
And now you've got the book. Sarianne Lair, what are you hearing from other fans?
We've had great feedback from our fans. We just had a giveaway for two copies of the book on our website, inatthecrossroads.com, and we had over 600 entries.
And Chelsea, what do you think it is about the food aspect of the series that's so appealing?
Well, I know that George Martin goes into a lot of detail about a number of things, from heraldry to clothing to place settings. And the food is one thing that really stands out, because while people might not want to put on a velvet doublet, everyone gets hungry. And the idea of being able to stave off that hunger with pork pie and a flagon of ale, I think, really hits a nerve with a lot of people.
Yeah, there's a richness to it. Although, yes. I, you know, wearing a velvet doublet while eating any of these things could
also
be...
that's win-win.
Right.
Yeah.
And you've brought two versions of pork pie for us. One, the medieval, one, the modern. What's the difference? But they're both beautiful. We're going to have pictures at hereandnow.org. They're just beautiful, what you've done on the top of the crust, you know, braided the crust in one case, and on the other there's a pig, a little pig that's sort of cut out of the crust. But what's the difference otherwise?
The medieval pie is more sweet than what we're used to from sort of modern pork pies. Our modern pork pie is very savory, and it has cheese and apples and barbecue sauce, and it's amazing. The medieval pork pie is also very good, but it's very different from what the modern palate is expecting. It has ginger in it, some honey, currants, and chopped up dates. And it's interesting to see how tastes have changed throughout the ages. Our medieval beef and bacon pie is also very sweet compared to the modern one.
And you also have a recipe for a common medieval spice mix. We've got it right here. It looks kind of brown, like cinnamon almost. What is it?
It is sort of a glorified cinnamon sugar, and it's a combination of sugar, ginger, cinnamon, galangale, cassia, if you can get it. I think we also have grains of paradise in there.
Grains of paradise?
Yes.
What is that?
It was a precursor to black pepper, mostly gone out of fashion nowadays, except it's sort of enjoying a revival in home brewing and microcraft brewing, because it was used for the same purpose way back when.
That's so interesting, because craft brewing is so popular now, and we're reminded that it's bringing us full circle.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Have you done your own beers yet?
We have, actually. We're just starting in on that. We've brewed a couple of beers and several meads and a few fruit wines we're going to get going this summer when the fruits are all in season.
Well, and before we let you go, is there a dish you want to make and you just haven't found the ingredients yet?
I've been on an epic quest to find lamprey for lamprey pie since we started this project.
Which all sounds really cool, like, wow, that could be cool, except then I looked it up, and a lamprey is a jawless eel.
Yeah.
That's so gross.
It is pretty gross, and I've overcome my fear of gutting eels recently, so I'm ready to take on the challenge of the lamprey.
Okay, well, you know, if you're into, you know, jawless eels that suck instead of bite and want one in a pie, well, then these are the gals for you. Chelsea Monroe Castle, Sari Ann Lehrer, their book is A Feast of Ice and Fire, the official companion cookbook to George R.R. Martin's best-selling Game of Thrones fantasy series. To see pictures of their culinary creations and hook up to their Inn at the Crossroads website, go to hereandnow.org. Chelsea, Sari Ann, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
The Game of Thrones Season 2 finale is Sunday on HBO. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.